22,000 words I can quote from your timeline. I snuck off that night while you slept and committed your voice to my memory. There were two things that I kept at the center of my system. The
Underwriting support for KRUI is provided in part by Hancher Auditorium. Since 1972, Hancher has been bringing music and performing arts to the University of Iowa. By supporting new works and artists, they continue to support the university's mission of teaching the people of Iowa City. For more information on upcoming events, dial 1-800-HANCHER or go to hancher.uiowa.edu.
Shall I? KRUI News at 5, brought to you in part by the Daily Iowan. This is KRUI Iowa City.
Hello, Iowa City. It's Wednesday, February 5, 2014, and you are listening to KRUI 89.7 FM. It's Wonder Woman Wednesday again at KRUI. I am your host, Sri Panada, here in the studio with Katie Kuntz, Albert Abreu, and our Wonder Woman of the Week, Zaina Arafat, a University of Iowa creative writing adjunct assistant professor who will talk to us about transcending cultures through writing. It's currently 8 degrees outside and sunny, but I will have more on your forecast coming up. First, let's take a look at today's headlines.
Did the biggest loser really win? Keep listening for more details. And thanks to science, one man can feel his fingers again. And stay tuned to hear what the world's most expensive Valentine's date would look like.
24-year-old Rachel Fredrickson won a grand prize of $250,000 on NBC's The Biggest Loser finale Tuesday night. Fredrickson, at 5 feet 5 inches, went from 260 pounds to 105 pounds, losing nearly 60% of her body weight. But although Fredrickson went through a dramatic weight loss transformation and won the game show, it looks like her win may not have been small enough. When Fredrickson came onto the stage during the finale, she was extremely thin. And her trainers, Bob Harper and Jillian Michaels, seemed to be very shocked or even scared. At her height and weight, Fredrickson has a body mass index of 17.5. According to the National Institutes of Health, anything under 18.5 is considered to be underweight. Fredrickson's trainers weren't the only ones who were surprised. Many followers of the show were expressing their astonishment on social media sites. Quote, "Are you kidding?" end quote, one woman wrote on the show's Facebook page. "Rachel looks anorexic. She has gone from one extreme to the other," end quote. Other posts called Fredrickson frail and said she seemed dizzy and disoriented on stage. Experts have stated that losing a significant amount of weight using unhealthy methods can be dangerous. Being too thin is just as harmful as being too fat. According to Dr. Stephen Lamb, weight management expert and medical director of NYU's Preston Robert Tisch Center for Men's Health, severe weight reduction can result in hormone disruption or bone thinning and can affect women's fertility as they stop menstruating. Quote, "If I were to see this in a patient, I would be concerned about their emotional stability," end quote, Lamb said. Fredrickson has yet to comment on the controversy.
There are apparently some disadvantages to losing a lot of weight in a short period of time, but even more obvious are the issues that accompany losing a body part, like losing your hand. One Denmark man, Dennis Sorensen, found out exactly what it was like to lose his hand 9 years ago after a firework accident, but now, thanks to modern medicine and advanced technology, is able to feel his bionic fingers at last. Scientists out of Switzerland implanted electrodes in the man's nerves so that he not only has the ability to control, but actually has a sensation of feeling through his prosthetic hand. To test whether the electrodes would work, researchers placed a variety of objects in the prosthetic hand, blindfolded Sorensen, played music through his headphones, and asked him to describe the objects that he held. Here is how Sorensen described the ability to feel again. Quote, "Suddenly, you could see my left hand was talking to my brain again, and it was magic," he said. "It was surreal. I grabbed the object in my hand, and I knew it was round. It was a baseball." If you would like to see more on this story and this research, check out the links at KRUI.fm or KRUI News on Facebook.
Think you have the best Valentine's Day planned? Think again. One London company has planned a Valentine's Day date so good it's better than yours, mine, and probably everyone else's in the world. For $100,000, luxury retail site Very First Two and culinary site Great British Chefs are offering the most holistic and romantic Valentine's Day experience you could think of. Michelin-starred chef Adam Simmons will actually come to your house and prepare a meal for you. And if you're located outside of the Greater London area, you'll have to spend close to another $100,000 in travel and accommodation costs. So what does this perfect date include? You'll get a live harpist, a romantic poet, a dozen white doves, rose petals, an 8-course meal with food so fancy I can't even pronounce it, and a whole lot of wine. How indulgent. But while you're treating yourself and your loved one, you'll also be helping those in need. With each package purchased, about $1,630 will be donated to a charity called the Prince's Trust. The deadline to purchase a package is February 11, just a few days away. Who says you can't buy love?
And if you're not getting the Valentine's Day of your dreams or the $100,000 Valentine's Day we just described, and you might still be angry with your ex, one London company may have just what you're looking for. Hexyourex.co.uk, the website operated by the London's The Last Tuesday Society, invites scorned exes to send in an article of clothing from their ex, email their photo, and choose from a variety of misfortunes they wish to befall on their ex-Valentine. If the lost love no longer has a clothing of their tormentor, they may choose a fabric to create the voodoo doll. Among the hexes one might choose include zero Twitter followers, impotence, and a prostate exam. The group is even hosting a sort of anti-Valentine's Day ball to be held next Friday for all the singles still angry with their exes. Check out this website by clicking on the link at KRUI.FM. It's hexyourex.co.uk.
But maybe instead of attempting to hex your ex with a European voodoo doll, you would prefer to let time heal your wounds, or better yet, let your brain do it for you. According to a new study just out of Northwestern University, our brains will rewrite our own memories, causing us to have a distorted picture of even very recent occurrences sometimes. Just think, can you remember what your mom looked like on your first day of school? Or do you just think of what she looked like now? According to researchers, a more recent picture will almost always override the old one, making our memories more of an ever-changing current and less of an accurate record.
Which is why we like to record things here at KRUI, and you can check out this newscast up on our website today, KRUI.FM, and click on the news tab. And now that's all we have for our news for you today, so let's hear from our Wonder Woman of the Week, Zaina Arafat. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And it's Zaina, isn't it?
Yeah,
Zaina. Okay, sorry about that.
No, don't worry about it.
Well, why don't you just tell us a little bit about, we know that you're an adjunct professor here at the University of Iowa, and you're teaching creative writing.
Yes, so I teach creative writing through the Magid Center for Undergraduate Writing here at Iowa, and I moved here 3.5 years ago to do my MFA in creative writing, and I've taught rhetoric here, and I've taught creative writing as well. And this semester, I'm teaching a class on writing across cultures and writing across identities.
So one thing our listeners might not know just from listening to you is that you're from Palestine originally, is that right?
Yeah, I'm a first-generation Palestinian-American. My parents immigrated the year before I was born, so.
And now in your class, are you teaching some of the things cross-culturally with the Middle Eastern cultures?
Yeah, actually, I mean, I'm trying to just get as wide a range of identities and cultures as I can that represented in the works that we're reading. But I think we're going to read a poetry collection that is, or some pieces from a poetry collection by a Lebanese author, a Lebanese-American author. Like, for example, we're reading Juno Diaz and Jhumpa Lahiri, you know, Juno Diaz being a Dominican-American, Jhumpa Lahiri being an Indian-American. And so we're just sort of trying to incorporate voices from all around the world.
Here at KRUI, we actually know Juno Diaz. He came on the show last time when he was traveling through here.
Oh, yeah. I remember when he was here last year. It was awesome. So he's great.
So tell us a little bit, you mentioned to me when we were sitting out before the show that you lived in Lebanon for some of your life.
Yeah, I've lived in Lebanon. I studied abroad there when I was in college as well. And so I've spent quite a lot of time in Beirut, which is one of my favorite cities. Generally speaking, I travel to the Middle East about twice a year. Now that I'm an adult, as a kid, I would just basically go all summer from, like, you know, the day after Memorial Day until the day before Labor Day, like all of summer break. And I triangulate between Jordan, which is where a lot of Palestinians went after 48 and 67, which were like the two major years in Palestinian history. So I triangulate between Jordan, Palestine, and Lebanon. I have a lot of Arab friends who've kind of done the same over the course of their lives. And it's sort of hard to know, you know, what home is exactly when you're doing that. But home's been Iowa for the last 3.5 years. So that's interesting.
So tell me, sometimes when we look at writing, especially from cultures in the Middle East, I had some experience last year working with a program on campus called Between the Lines. Mm-hmm. And it was a group of kids who came from the Middle East to the United States. And sometimes when we look at those things, it turns out that it's hard to avoid the politics, especially right. Living in that region. Do you think that's something that you also teach in your classes?
Well, I'm trying not to. I mean, so in terms of my own, for example, like my goal, I started out I was a foreign affairs and a philosophy major in college. I then did a master's in international affairs. And originally I wanted to write, you know, about politics and politics of the region. And then I realized that like that is probably the least effective route to changing anything is like hitting the issues head on. And so I, in my own writing, like try and avoid talking about politics, especially when it comes to Middle East politics are like such a contentious thing that you want to kind of avoid it unless you're, you know, on the right side in the eyes of the American media and all that. So I avoid that in my own writing and I try to avoid it in class as much as possible as well, because I don't think that that's, you know, useful when it comes to the kind of writing that really engages and affects people. I mean, it's always going to indirectly touch on politics, but coming at it from the side rather than directly, being subversive about it by going through art is, I think, a much better way to, you know, affect the quote-unquote politics of a region.
Now, you mentioned something really interesting just now, and you said that you think sometimes you need to be on the American side of a certain politic, which is interesting because we hear a lot about the censorship there, but not necessarily censorship here, but maybe just being frowned upon here. Can you tell us a little bit more what you mean by that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's interesting that you like, yes, I think that as an Arab American, I know that there are very strong and powerful lobbying groups that kind of lobby against the interest of Palestinians and perhaps the larger Arab community. And so with the kind of strength that those groups have, you kind of don't want to put yourself so much out there in the other direction, if that makes sense, which it might not. It's just that, you know, I mean, I try. So this is an issue that I like try to avoid talking about. But I think everyone knows that when it comes to like talking about Palestine and Israel, it's very fraught
contentious.
With contention, exactly. And it's just easier to be subversive when talking about it. So, even right now, I'm being subversive.
No, absolutely. And I don't mean to stick you with a hard question right at the beginning.
No,
but
it's fine. I like hard questions.
How do you deal with some of these things? So if, like, for example, my experience has been very passionate poetry from these young kids. Oh, last summer, they were 16 to 18 or so. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, feeling like you don't have a sense of home, or sometimes with people. I think one girl lived in Egypt and she was very upset that there's constant war and people are in danger. And so it's hard to stop. I think because when you write, it generally comes from the heart and it's hard to stop that. So how do you confront those things?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because when I was first starting out, I couldn't, you know, my anger and like frustration and sadness was the propelling force. And it was like the subject matter. But I think I now see that, especially after having moved to Iowa, I think that the best thing I can do and the best way to sort of like challenge that, you know, that raw emotion is by being here as I exist as a sort of Palestinian American, that like by encountering people who might kind of what's always bothered me most is people's perceptions of Arabs, and like and all that they see in the media is like, you know, Arabs shooting guns in the air and screaming Allahu Akbar and all that. And so I think that when people meet me here, if they've never encountered like an Arab, which actually I often ask my classes, like, have you ever met an Arab? And often they'll say, once somebody said we had one in our hometown, like sometimes people, they just don't have the familiarity, and that's, you know, that's fine. That's normal. And so just sort of by existing here as such and kind of putting a human face on Arabs, that for me does more than writing these like very politically fraught pieces that will never, ever infiltrate a mainstream. Does that make sense?
I think it does, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, even with like people from other races, a lot of people often say they've never seen, I don't know, like a person from India or even a black person in their town in Iowa. Mm-hmm. How are you dealing with this in your class? Like, how do you transcend cultures?
Well, I mean, as it happens, I have a really wonderful group of students, and they're incredibly diverse in terms of like ethnicity and then just like like background. I mean, I don't even mean ethnically speaking. And so it's very easy to like transcend culture in a group and to like talk across cultures and to, you know, teach pieces that are written by people of different backgrounds to a group of students that's so kind of like seem open-minded and like curious and intelligent and just like exposed, it seems. So it's very, it's been very, you know, I was a little nervous going into it. And it might not be, it might just be that I have a fantastic group of students, but it's been really, I've gotten so much out of it in terms of talking about across culture as well. So from them.
No, we know that you're from the Middle East, mm-hmm. but those aren't the only two cultures you're talking about in your class. Is
no,
that right?
No, of course not. Yeah. Sorry.
Continue. Oh, no, go keep going. Tell me more. What are you teaching in your class?
I mean, so let's see here. So we are, first of all, we're like, right now we're looking at writers that embody, that can be said to be either in between or both, right, of something. And so we're, as I said, I mentioned Jhumpa Lahiri, Juno Diaz, Zadie Smith, who's one of my all-time favorite writers, will be looking at Ulib Bis, we'll be looking at a French writer, Emmanuel Carrère, we'll be looking at writers that immerse themselves in other cultures, whether or not they themselves embody like a duality of any sort. We'll be looking at writers that, you know, are basically, that come from different, perhaps like gender identification backgrounds or sexual orientation as well. And so we'll be studying like Hollinghurst and Jeanette Winterson and, you know, lots of writers that, as I like to say when like people ask me to describe the class, it's basically just writing from the outside that doesn't fall within the like traditional mainstream when it comes to either subject matter or identity. So
you said a word there that I'm not sure that everyone is necessarily familiar with. You said duality. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I think everybody in the studio right now, for example, embodies some duality in one form or another. I am both Palestinian and American. I am both, in many ways, feminine and masculine. I am both, like, you know, white and a woman of color. Like, they're just, I'm both happy and sad, right? And so, like, and each person here does embody some either, like, directly, seemingly contradictory identities or just, you know, something where you can put a hyphen in between, right? And so I like those, I like thinking about contradictions that exist within the self. And I think that makes for some of the most interesting writing is writing that just like is contradictions on the page and the voice itself is almost conflicted. So I think that's, you know, that's really what I mean when I say duality. And of course in like 2014, it's so much more common to encounter people that are basically walking contradictions or that embody two different cultures within their one self.
So it is this breaking stereotypes kind of?
Yeah, or? That's exactly, I mean, that's exactly what the goal is, right? Like that in terms of my own writing for one, like the only thing I was saying recently that the only thing that keeps it from being 100% indulgent, like this writing exercise of mine, of writing projects and all that, is that there's that, you know, whatever, 1% that's maybe more, hopefully more than 1%, but that percentage that's, that is by virtue of existing on the page, the work is like dispelling stereotypes, as well as, you know, consciously doing so, right? Like right now I'm writing, or I wrote a book. The first book project that I was working on is, about a Palestinian American woman. And the goal is to essentially slay common misperceptions and stereotypes of Arab American women. Right, that they're like stifled, that they're repressed, that they're conservative, that they're not like sexual creatures, and all of that. So that's part of the project, part of the goal. And the same for in the class is that, like, you know, we read work that hopefully breaks a lot of common stereotypes, and we also like watch videos that do the same. On the first day, we watched a video of a Palestinian female race car driving team. So I thought that was pretty cool because people don't think of, you know, Arab women as race car drivers. So, yeah.
You mentioned also when we were talking earlier that you don't necessarily want to talk about politics or the things that make you angry. Mm-hmm. How do you subverse those emotions? How do you do that?
Well, yeah, I mean, by being funny, really. Like I when I think of like, artists that have changed the way that people view their ethnic group. Often humor is a huge tool that they use, especially like I think of like, you know, the Jewish American population like 50, 60 years ago was openly discriminated against. And through like Mel Brooks and other, you know, prominent
Seinfeld.
Right, Jerry's, exactly, Larry David, all that. Like, people now, like, nobody, like, it's hard to even remember a time in which, you know, there was so much, like, anti-Semitism in the States. And I think, you know, humor and just, like, creating plays, shows, movies that had nothing to do with politics but were just funny stories in which the characters happened to be Jewish just put a very friendly face on an otherwise maligned population.
It sort of humanizes them in ways that the politics can't do.
I mean, politics is like the worst way to go about humanizing people, right? Like I think when people think of Palestinians, they think of like, oh gosh, like politics, right? Like the longest standing issue on the U.S. foreign policy agenda. It's people are tired of politics. They want stories. So
I think that's probably a fairly good assumption and way to clean that up. So when you're traveling between the United States and the Middle East, what are some of the things, how do you write about those things and what are some of the things you've learned?
Well, that's a good question. It's a great question actually and really difficult to answer. So I have dual citizenship and every time I travel, it's a choice of which passport should I travel on, right? If I'm traveling from America to Jordan, I'm going to travel on my Jordanian passport because